Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another edition of Warrior Connection. Well, we finally got some sunshine here in Illinois. Out there in Colorado, Denise has got sunshine out there, too. Do you, Denise? Denise, are you there? Okay, well, we're waiting for Denise to come on. Plan is, like last week, we started discussing what's been happening in Washington and continued on some more updates, a lot of stuff happening there. And so we're just continuing on that. I think it was interesting, in the last segment, they were talking about MREs and meals ready to eat. And supposedly there's a pizza announcement out there. I mean, I've been gone. I haven't had any MREs for quite a while, although I think all of us still have some of those stashed away for us. Denise, are you there yet? David, are you there?
Okay. Yeah, I'm here. This is David Lachelle. I'm here, Doug.
Hey, great, David. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Thank you.
Yeah, how's everything going? What happened out in Washington?
Listen, we had such a great bunch of Gulf War veterans go out there and give a message about what we're going through. We got the point across that are not only the veterans themselves, but their families and their children. And believe me, Doug, when I tell you that we had plenty of questions go to the group before we left, we had many of the staffers in tears.
Well, that's good. I mean, you know, the problems just seem to escalate all the time. I mean, the news on what's happened out there in the Southwest again, we got a hospital out there where supposedly vets died because they didn't get care. You got waiting lists. But, I mean, we keep hearing those same stories over and over again all over the place, and yet nothing happens or nothing changes. Do you think you got up to the people in Washington this time where they started to listen?
I think we made progress quite a bit. I got a positive feeling about what we did. I know that the ones that I talked to were very receptive, and I can't tell you how much it meant to see how well we were received by most of the congressmen and the senators. So it's one of those things. It's all positive, but we have to wait to see what the outcome is.
What kind of message did you guys present to them? What information did you have and give to them so we have an idea?
Doug. This is Denise.
Hey, fantastic.
I wanted to tell you, we concentrated on the Senate because at that time we had short notice that the Senate letter that senators sign on with our leads in the Senate for appropriations funding for the CDMRP, Gulf War Illness Research Program. We concentrated on that because we had a deadline of May 1st to close the business. So last year we had 6 senators sign on. This year we had 11. And that was a big push to get senators to sign on with the letter from Baldwin and Rockefeller to support our funding at the CDMRP for Gulf War Illness Research Program. And there may have been more that sent separate letters of support because on the House side, we, you know, had good sign up on their letter, and we have each year increased the numbers of House representatives supporting that. We had no money, definite money amount on the House bill, on the House letter. On the Senate letter, somebody put in $25 million.
That's an increase, isn't it?
It would be $5 million increase. Now, Republicans really don't like to see a certain amount, so the Republicans that were supporting us would send their separate letters of supporting the continuation of robust or strong funding for our program. We pointed out strongly that CDMRP program has, 35-40 programs on it. Out of those, that amount, we have 3 that are directly war-related, our Gulf War Illness Research, our Traumatic Brain, and our PTSD. Now, the VA does good research on PTSD, on Traumatic Brain. Our funding on research has gone down for the Gulf War Illness Research at the VA. and their research is not as hardcore looking at the diagnostic methods, the biomarkers, and treatment trials as the CDMRP is. So we needed that funding, and that was our first priority. We also informed them, and they knew about our house goal and were interested in it. So the other message was, you know, support us on getting this house bill over to the Senate, and, you know, let's get this rolling and get it completed this session of Congress. Our RAC members that are the older members are being pink flipped on September 30th. So it's imperative that we get this House bill worked all the way through, and if we could get a Senate bill that mirrors exactly the same as the House bill, it would help us get there faster. And so that was the two issues that we asked. The asks are the key things that we need them to do right now. We had briefings with Jim Benz in attendance, Anthony in attendance, and our veterans that had traveled across the country to come. We brought up issues when we let other veterans speak. We brought up issues about inaccuracies that are put down on the VA records for veterans of the Gulf War. We brought up the problem with our care and the doctors being aware of what's really going on with Gulf War illness. We brought up the issue of claims. But our, you know, primary two big asks were the bill and the sign-on for supporting our CDMRP funding.
Yeah, let's go back on this House bill. This House bill that you're talking about is 4261. And yes, Kaufman and Mrs. Kirkpatrick and Mr. McCloud. And again, the bill to improve the research of Gulf War illness, the Research Advisory Committee on Gulf War Veterans Illness, and for other purposes. And
now,
again,
currently, when we initially set this up, the RAC, the VA had all the power to put everybody on, all members of the RAC. What we did is we found a role model used at the Department of Education. And how it's going to be set up if we get this bill passed is that three would be chosen by the VA to be on the RAC. Four would be chosen from the House VA, the chairman, and the ranking member. And then the other four would be from the Senate VA committee, again, from the chairman and the ranking member. So it would turn around from the VA having total choice of all members to them only being able to affect three members on the panel. It is revenue neutral. All we're doing is shifting the power curve, per se, that the VA doesn't have total control over this committee. We need to maintain the independence of the committee. And like I said, it's revenue neutral, so it should be an easy do because it doesn't cost any more money than we already have involved.
Yeah, so this is just establishing the criteria for how the committee functions and who controls the committee, correct?
Correct. That's what it gets down to. There's some other things in it, like we had in that same bill that set up the original RAC about a study on MS in Gulf War vets that they have not done. So that's brought forward in more clear, definite language that study will be done.
Yeah, I mean, the MS is, and multiple sclerosis is extraordinarily important, all of this stuff. I mean, we got all the neurological problems that we're seeing, and we've been seeing from day one that we knew were going to happen because when we look at all the toxic exposures we had, all of the chemical, biological exposures, all the hazardous materials, all that stuff points directly at all the neurological problems, and all that stuff is manifesting itself as fibromyalgia, you know, MS and got a, you know, Lou Gehrig's disease. I mean, the numbers are staggering, aren't they?
They are. And so we really need this bill. It is concerning that we have a few individuals, we will not name them, with a certain organization that are fighting against us on this bill. That is a betrayal of the veteran community, as I feel. And I won't go into it anymore, but their feeling is don't trust the politicians, and I will say, excuse me, you're putting all your trust in the VA, and the VA has not done us right, so why should we put all of our trust in the VA And if we have this model from the Department of Education, we should use it and move forward with this new model that's functioned well in the Department of Education. And we've had successes with the RAC until this current secretary came on board. And David Lachelle, thank you for getting that picture of Secretary Shinseki. He was in the building, and David got a picture of him with him on the elevator. David personally invited him to come to the meeting. He did not. He has not shown his face at any RAC meeting since he came in as Secretary of the VA.
That's weird. Why wouldn't the Secretary of the VA, who was commanding general, that wrote the medical orders himself for mandating medical care for all of us, for DU and everything, not show up to a RAC meeting? I just don't understand that.
It's a good one, isn't it? this has never happened to us before. We always had Secretary of VA support from Princeppi, from everybody, since we started this RAC, and it seems like Shinseki is going back to blaming it on stress and letting his people go that direction. Two of the appointees that he wanted on were definitely stress, psychosomatic, stress and Gulf War illness type people. And they were pushed back for now. They weren't put on for now, which means September 30th when Mr. Benz has gotten his pink slip. I will tell the veterans out there, I have attended every RAC meeting. Yes, I worked on the initial bill and helped get it passed. And I support this bill totally and completely. I have been there. I have seen the VA change their tune too many times. They are blocking our progress and firing some of the most dedicated people that we've had on the Gulf War illness issue.
I guess I come back to the same thing, and I have to, I mean, you and I were involved in putting a lot of briefings together and at all different levels during the war and after the war. You and we've all of us worked together getting up there. You guys were just out there. David and all you guys were up there. Fantastic. But I guess I'm at a total loss, and I don't understand. General Shinseki in 1993 knew, based on our direct input, that medical care was required, specialized training and education was required, total environmental remediation was required, and he signed the order mandating it as a one-star general. So then we put all this stuff together, and again, it bothers me to no end, and all the people that work with me that, you know, the DU project didn't exist and I wasn't the director, but we did, and we were, and we were absolutely there. So we wrote the Army regulations that he mandated. And then, lo and behold, he signed them, Army Regulations 700-48, mandating all of this stuff again. So I'm at a total loss, you know, because David, again, our U.S. Marine, sent that stuff to us here again from a problem out there in Nevada where they individuals sick from the DU exposures, and yet the same nonsense keeps coming down on DU and everything else. And I understand where Charles Engel came on this idea, and you and I were both up there. It was March of 2001 when Charles Engel at Walter Reed was pushing for the stress, the whole thing, and pushing stress. It doesn't make any sense at all to me. I'm lost.
David Lachelle, are you still there?
David, are you there?
I'm still here.
David, tell us about your encounter on the elevator.
I don't know how it came about that I was singled out, but I was the only one standing there when Secretary Shinseki walked up. I was surprised. He asked me where I was going. I told him I was going to the RAC. Would he be attending? And he just shook his head no. And I got my picture and then went on up. But he didn't have too much more to say about it once I told him I was going to the RAC committee.
Yeah. Doug, one of the things that the VA used their funds to study was a animal model for using Prozac in Gulf War veterans.
You know, we've got such a nightmare. We hear day in and day out of individuals that are put on these psychotropic drugs, and they're having a nightmare with these psychotropic drugs. We've got over and over again conversations about the interaction between psychotropic drugs and everything else. And I got to come back to our own experience. And I mean, you know, I've been around doing you, and I've been around since the Vietnam War and all the other guys. And I mean, been in and out for a long time. These psychotropic drugs don't really do anything to alleviate the problems that you're looking at. I mean, as Rollo said it when he came in here, all they do is put you into a fog and put your memory into a lost bank someplace, and they keep you under control, but it doesn't really resolve any problems. It kind of numbs and dumbs you down, and I guess
well,
I'm at a loss on this, totally
I'm
a loss.
Looking at one of the, I'm looking at the studies projected for VA funding. One of them out of Cincinnati, Ohio. I'll just give you the title of it, okay? Somatic Hypersensitivity in Veterans with Irritable Bowel Syndrome. I don't like that word, somatic. let's see, another one. Like I said, they did the Prozac one. They have some here that may be of interest, but like I said, the CDMRP is leading the way. And like one of them, prevention of hippocranial neurodegeneration due to age and apnea. I'm not sure how directly that relates to Guffor illness.
What is that again?
Prevention of hippocranial neurodegeneration due to age and apnea.
I have no idea. They're looking at brain function is all they're doing. I don't know.
Then there's one on epigenetic mechanisms relevant to the pathogenesis of ALS. We do know we have ALS, but that is a, you know, small group of Guffor vets so far that have it. And they have ALS for all veterans now. I don't know why that would be put on our portfolio for Guffor illness research. We have to be careful how they divvy these things up.
Well, Mike Donnelly, I remember Mike was, I mean, he flew a fighter and he went through the contaminated area. We know this aircraft was contaminated. We know he got back to contaminated areas. We know the stuff was brought back to the base and the base was contaminated. Well, I remember when Mike started coming down with ALS, as we saw him deteriorate, and you and I were actually there where some of his medical exams were done by an extraordinary doctor that both of us know.
Yeah.
And all that showed up real fast because I actually remember the PSOB, Presidential Special Oversight Board doctor, when they saw that physiological exam on Mike Donnelly and the ALS and then saw a simmer physiological for neurological function exam and other people, she was just freaking out going, it's all here, isn't it? It's all here together, isn't it?
Another one. Another one that would apply probably to all veterans and not specific to Guffor would be one that's titled Sleep Neurobiology and Circuitry, you know, the circuits in the sleep. Now, yes, we have sleep problems, but I want to know how many samples patients, and if they are Guffor patients or just any patient that's a veteran. These are some of the things we have to dig through when they say what they're going to fund to really look at if it really applies to Guffor illness, if they're using Guffor veterans in this study group, or if it's a mixed bag. If it's a mixed bag, it's not specific to Guffor. So, you know, I'm still going through this list that they just presented at the RAG meeting, and I got a copy of one of our vets on the committee, you know, gave me the copy. Of course, VA didn't bring enough to put on the table for everybody at the meeting to pick up, and that's not appropriate. If you're having a public meeting, you should have copies of all the documents on the table to be picked up by the people that come to attend and not just to the committee members. Another thing that's going on was that's not fully understood by the other side in our veteran group, and it's kind of fighting against us, is that the RAC was, when they changed the charter, and when it was initially set up, it covered reviewing all research by any federal funds, okay, which would include NIH, you know, any group that's federally funded. Now, they changed that, and that is why Mr. Jim Benz could not put in the section of reviewing, you know, all the federal funds, which a lot comes from the VA. So that could not be put into the report, and that was from the charter changes that these individuals did not understand how it really impacted the workings of the RAC. And it's sad. I feel devastated that there's a split in the veterans community. We have to avoid that. And, you know, it's devastating when that happens, when you have veterans saying one thing to their reps and the other group saying another thing. You know, we have to, you know, agree to be on the same principle. And apparently we have a split in our Gulf War veteran community.
Well, there's been a split in the veterans community for as long as I can remember. I mean, going back to when I was small, I mean, looking at the, you know, World War One vets and then looking at World War Two vets, Korean. All of us were Vietnam era and everything through. There's been a split across the veterans community on all of these things. And again, that thing bothers me completely. David, are you still there? Do you have some other comments?
Yeah, I've been listening a little bit, and on the psychotropic side of it, there's a little bit I can talk about. I do not take the real heavy Prozac and Valium and that kind of junk. I am one of the few that refuse any kind of hardcore. The one thing I can say is working with a good team, which I have here at Dayton, I have worked 2.5 years to get the right combination to do the things that I have difficulties with. And working with that team, I finally came up with something that is, it moderates my problems, but it also moderates my pain. It's manageable. There is no way in the world I don't think anybody could get cured from this, but if you can get to a point of manageability, then you can at least bring part of that quality of life back. The other thing that you mentioned about the one aircraft that flew through the contaminated area, I was in RAF Fairford, and we flew B-52s over the area. I can attest to the fact that our first missions, the first 4 or 5, were low-level bombings. It brought something back to mind, and I did a little research on the Gulf War assessment, bomb assessment. And I come up with an Air Force bomb assessment for the Gulf War. And from that, I can pull out some of the data. They say in this report that 75% of the NBC sites were bombed and destroyed. If we have 75%, you kind of think of it, we have 3 bombers running through that area. The first one, not so bad. The second one catches all the smoke, all the contamination that might be thrown up in the air. The third one catches it all. In that thought, you know, I go back in my mind to the time I spent in RAF Fairford. I looked at the regulations required by the Air Force when they're thinking there's a contamination. At the end of the runway, when these planes come back, they're supposed to have a team there to do a decon, to check the planes before disembarking, so that if they know something is wrong, they can get the proper decon done on that plane before it hits the field or hits back. We never had one. There was no thought given to having one.
Well, I mean, I had to come back to decontamination because from work that I've done setting up the decon stations and everything else, we know on a simple vehicle, on a simple Humvee or on a simple, you know, medical box, we had called the 880s, you know, it's virtually impossible to get solid decontamination done because the contamination is all over the place and on an aircraft. I mean, when we put together decontamination for aircraft and looked at it, we know that doesn't work. I mean, there's no way to fully decontaminate an aircraft, much less any type of vehicle that's got into a contaminated area. And anybody thinks that you can decon it is dreaming. That's what got Mike Donnelly, why they came back to the States and the family members got cross-contaminated once the aircraft got back to the States.
And that goes back to the fact, too, that if you look at any MSDS data sheet that we maintain within the United States for critical contamination, the one thing that's stated in just about every one of them, I've looked at several, the one thing that's stated in most of them is you can only go so far to get it decontaminated to a certain health risk. So they minimize, but they don't eliminate.
Well, yeah, that's what we're working at, because, again, when we put this together for the military, the whole objective was complete the military mission and just with no concern for the health effects in anybody.
Now, there's one thing that happened when I gave my testimony at the advisory committee. They wanted to know how the progression went, and I got into the thought, like I have asked, you know, like I told you just a little bit ago, I got into it. We need a two-way communication where we can work with a PCP. If that PCP can find a manageable condition, it somehow needs to get up so they can understand and see the data that comes out of that. And I happened to mention something about rheumatology and my rheumatoid arthritis. My rheumatologist, the doctor I see over at the VA clinic, actually stated to me, we have two genes that are prevalent in RA patients from the Gulf War that are not prevalent in the civilian side. And when I said that, there was a commotion in the back. We had staff, I guess, from OPH and also from the DOD, and they started pecking on their computers real quick. I love Joel Graves and what he did for me, because he says, I've got that information. And he started punching his computer, and before I was done with the testimony, he come back to me and said, I found it. He actually sent it to me in the email. One of the two people in the back seen him rush out of the room. The DOD guy actually said, oh shit, we found something. Pardon me, I didn't mean that. But it started a commotion. So, you know, I hit a straw somewhere. I'm not quite sure what kind of straw I hit, but they knew it.
And, you know, the other thing I want to say is when we first started the RAC, the only public comment came from the ones that were in attendance. And Mr. Benz started opening up for phone call comments about 2 years ago in Boston. We had Dr. Guam defer her presentation to give the veterans more time that were there in attendance and on the phone lines to do public comment. I think we got everybody on the phone to have their chance at public comment. We had everybody in the room that had their chance at public comment. And I want to tell you, normally, you know, on a advisory committee, they don't take, calls from the public that are listening in on the meeting by phone. So Mr. Benz has gone to all lengths to involve the Gulf War vets and have them be heard, to also involve us on the Hill visits when he and the former member of the RAC, Anthony Hardy, had lined up meetings. So we were most gratefully and encouraged to speak up after they, you know, covered the two, you know, issues that we needed to ask for the bill and the funding, and the floor was opened up to the vets that came with that group, and then we were able to pair up our group and send them to visit other senators and reps that weren't on the appointment sheet. So I just want to say that we have a team of very dedicated individuals that the vets
are very intelligent
through. And that the veterans are most definitely welcomed on the Hill. Most of us wore our Gulf War caps and created quite a lot of talking in the hallways of, oh, there's the Gulf War vets. We're not normally seen up there until we have a problem. And so they know we were there. Even if it was only 12 vets, they know. We did do a silent protest outside of the VA headquarters at lunchtime on the first day with posters. We stood there silently holding our posters, saying we're tired of the secret agenda the VA has, that we need help, we need care, we need to protect our research advisory committee to be what it was originally intended to be, an independent committee that reviews all government-funded research for Gulf War illness. Has Keith called in?
Keith, are you there? Okay.
Yeah. I guess not.
Pardon?
I guess he hasn't.
Okay. Hey, David, what do you see as still the major problems that got to be corrected from your point of view?
My point is, and I hear it from the community, it's not just my perspective on this, is if you watch in the news, a lot of times you see a battle between medicine and psychiatry. It comes down to us, too, because there are some out there as far as caregivers in the VA, the doctors. One will take the view, yes, I'm interested in Gulf War illness, and they will work with you. And then there's the others that said, no, not at all, I don't believe in it, and they just go on and do their job. The breakdown is that they haven't gotten word out to those doctors that we have a group of individuals, like the Gulf War 1991, that you don't have information on, and you need it. You've got to have it. You've got to have that communication, not only from the top, but from us going up. A review panel, you know, of PCPs working on Gulf War vets, it would be those two tied together. And if we can get that two-way communication going, not only do the researchers benefit, but we do at the bottom, because now we've got the attention and the proper care to go along with it. And I realize one thing above all things. Primary care physician at the VA sees so many different eras of veterans, World War II, Korean, Vietnam, Gulf War, Iraqi freedom, and also the Afghanistan vets. Every one of us is kind of different in their own way. They've got it boiled down. I really have a lot of respect for World War II veterans. They were, in my mind, looking back, they were not properly taken care of, but they got the health care, the minor stuff. And they're proud of what they did, and that's what they continued on with. Vietnam veterans, they got their Agent Orange. They're working right now on the Korean vets with the same thing. They've worked on the Camp Lejeune contamination, and they're looking at McClellan right now. And the Gulf War veterans, right now, they're trying to group us into a solid group where we're part of OIF. And even the difference between Gulf War 1991 and the Operation Iraqi Freedom people, there's a difference there. They didn't see the contamination or be in the contamination like we were. And that's the biggest problem, is they don't see it. And they've skewed the numbers so bad that they only recognize, you know, that one in four Gulf War veterans have put in a claim. Well, they've only allowed 20% of those to be rated for Gulf War, and they're saying we're not seeing the problem.
Actually,
for Gulf War, we were at 300,000 back in 2008, with way over 250 already approved at that time. So, I mean, the numbers is another thing I keep finding out looking weird, because when you look at the actual internal documents, Griffith's reports, the other epidemiology, the numbers that have gone in for medical care is staggering. We're looking at 60 to 70%. And the same thing with OIF and OEF. I mean, we're at 60%.
Okay, but
that's overall
PTSD injuries in the battle zone. But Gulf War illness, when you wean it all down, Gulf War illness is not not as high of numbers of the irritable bowel, the chronic fatigue, the fibromyalgia, the other complaints. When you really dissect it down, and that's what the scientists have to do, is it's probably around, currently what the researchers are accepting is 35% at the high level. It could be higher, but currently, you know, what they're looking at. And you have to discount the PTSD, you have to discount other injuries in the war zone to get the accurate numbers.
And that's the thing about...
And the numbers, have shifted and shifted and shifted again. And David Lachelle just said 20%, and I think that was from the Military Times article. We have documentation, watch for the news in the next week, that it's less than 20% for the Gulf War veterans. It is much less.
And you have to look at it, Doug, in this respect, too, because I know that we have defective chromosomes that led possibly to the RA. They don't accept that, okay? You look at, when you go to a PCP, the primary care diagnoses you with an illness. If that doesn't fit the category, or if it overlaps into IBS or CFS, they will not give you that presumption.
And that's another thing. The claim system is messed up. It has totally been messed up all along. But when there is no uniformity between each VARO of what they accept as Gulf War illness, be it chronic fatigue, fibro, and grant those, that is where a problem is, too. There is no training, effective training, let's put it that way, effective, appropriate training for the VARO, the rating administrators that decide on the claims, on the Gulf War illness claims. It's so widely variant from each and every state. So one of the things I brought up to one of the congressmen is to ask for the Colorado data from the VARO in Denver to get that data of how many of these are Gulf War illness claims, be it chronic fatigue, fibro, undefined, whatever they want to call it, and find out how many have been approved by each VA regional office. So there is a need there for the claims adjudicators to get their act together and be fair across the board, no matter where you live. The care is, I call the care and the healthcare providers at the VA the, you know, place where the metal hits the metal. I mean, the metal hits the rubber. If they don't get it right, your claim's not going to go right.
Well,
and then we have the research problem.
The other problem we've had from day one, and this is the hiding of the documents. We have all the internal reports from within the Department of Defense and the military, all the branches, and they're going with the CDC, confirming the health effects from these toxic exposures. We have the known levels of toxic exposures. We know the health effects from this. It's been known from day one. We taught all this at the beginning of Desert Storm. And yet, the average guy that goes to apply for this stuff, he goes to wherever VSO, Veteran Service Officer, is going to get it. If he doesn't have the document, even though the VA leadership and the Department of Defense leadership has the document, the report, they're not going to share it with him. And what I've had experience with the Veteran Service Officer, and I hear over and over and over again, is they don't share any of the actual documents that they have confirming the health effects, confirming directing medical care with the guy. In other words, the soldier, the sailor, the airman, Navy, Marine, whatever you got, Coast Guard, they got to provide the documents, even though the VSO might have the documents in their office. I mean, what's wrong with this picture? I mean, it goes back to day one. I mean, Lieutenant General Block made the decision to disregard the health and environmental effects of all these toxic exposures. And they've held to it from day one. I mean, that began in December of 1990 once we made the decision to blow up all of Iraq's chemical and biological stockpiles plus all the other stuff we did. Jeez. Some days I want to cry.
This is like a story right out of Vietnam. It's still going on and on and on with the Agent Orange. I cannot believe 40 years after that war was over, they're still coming up and adjusting for the Agent Orange. How many died waiting for that adjustment to happen? And how long are we going to have to keep it up until we get recognized? Heck, I'm going on. I'm 57 years old. I'm going, you know, they can write me off as old age as far as that goes. But I'm telling you, that goes along with the multiple illnesses that we do receive. It ages you faster and faster every time you get another diagnosis.
Denise, what do you think is going to happen out of the meetings last week?
Well, I think we have good support on the Hill. I encourage, the one big ask I have of everybody listening, please call your elected U.S. representative in their D.C. office and ask specifically for the veteran staffer. That is the person that handles all these issues for the Congress people, you know, man or woman. And talk to him about your feelings in support of our bill. And, you know, tell him we need him to co-sponsor that bill. That is imperative for each veteran, for each family member, each civilian, to make these calls. And it's H.R. 4261, the Gulf War Health Research Reform Act of 2014. It's very easy. It doesn't take very much time to call up to D.C. You can go on House.gov to get your list of representatives and find out who represents you and at least make that one phone call. That one phone call right now. It's what's important is we have a bill on the floor in the House. And right now I think we have 8 co-sponsors. That should be a lot higher. If the vets have been calling and emailing their representative, that should be a lot higher right now than it is. So I really tell you that the best way is a phone call. Emails, they have a legislative correspondent, as they called it, the job. That is the first job that some of the staffers get, is to be a correspondent or to be a person to learn about tours of the Congress building. You know, those are their initial positions as they move in. They're not as informed as a veteran staffer, the military liaison. Those are the people you have to get to get down to specifics of why we need this bill and why they need to get their boss to co-sponsor this bill. It's imperative. I almost decided to stay another week because I am concerned about the numbers that we have as co-sponsors, and I was about ready to stay another week to go work the Hill like I have done in the past. I mean, Doug, you were up there with me once. And that was mainly for briefings and not for a particular bill. And I have walked that Hill, starting at the top of every building, gone to every office of every building, 3 House buildings, 3 Senate buildings, 435 reps, 100 senators. And it's hard work, but I've done it in support of making changes and getting improvement for our Gulf War vets, which I'm one of. And as a nurse officer, I retired as a major. I had a master's degree. I came home, started speaking out early because it was an ethical, moral issue to stand up and speak out and to brief people of what was going on. And I did a lot of those briefings, you know, just going in and briefing them of this is what's going on and this is a critical need and we need you to pay attention. Then I worked in... When you're going out there for a House bill, all you're trying to do is ask them to co-sponsor a bill. You know, it takes maybe 15 minutes. Maybe. You want to stick to the subject, answer any of their questions they have, move on to the next office. And a lot of vets, and we educated 12 vets that came, of how you have to work on the Hill to get them informed of what's actually been going on and to get their support. It's a huge job. We don't have a paid lobbyist to do that. It comes from initiative of the veteran themselves to get up there and speak out and to push for a bill. And you've got to have a key thing that you're asking for. You're asking them to co-sponsor a bill that they not only will vote for it, but they'll put their name out there before it ever gets to a vote.
You know, I think one of the big problems, and I have to go back all the way back to Vietnam, where, you know, I first put my fingers into it and got my butt in the wrong location at the wrong time. In all these wars, Vietnam, all the way through Desert Storm and OIF, OEF, the actual number of wounded in action or killed in action during enemy engagement as far as a proportion of the casualties is small. I mean, you know, we're looking at what we call disease and non-battle injury is the overwhelming proportion, probably 80 to 90%, maybe even higher, of all the casualties fall into that category. And I know within Desert Storm we had less than 1,000 actual casualties during the war. And as we know, and the documents are all there, a majority of those were wounded in action, killed in action in Desert Storm, were friendly fire with depleted uranium. But we've got all these wars that, again, the ethical and moral questions is way up there. I mean, I've got the same thing. You know, we told one thing and we find out another. But then we see the incredible numbers of casualties that we have. And I don't think the public wants to acknowledge it. I don't think the veterans organizations want to acknowledge that, because that's the experience I've had when talking to them. And I don't think the VA wants to acknowledge it, because they put out this myth that there were no casualties and nothing happened. These were a sanitized war. You've got very, very few people, casualties, i.e. wounded in action, killed in action. And instead they're ignoring the disease and non-battle injury. How do we get around this, guys?
I think the VVA has a new approach, and I don't have the bill number, but I'll get it and see if we can get Rick to come on the show next week. But they have sponsored a bill about toxic injuries that is broad and would cover all errors. And I think that's what we have to focus on. You know, many of us have said we'd rather come back with an amputation. You put a, you know, one nice new prosthetics on and you go on with your life. You go up to the ski clinics and you go with the road races with the especially adaptable vehicles. This is more devastating, and people do not understand the invisible toxic wounds from any
other. I'm sorry, Denise. Go ahead.
No, go ahead, Dave.
Doug, I want to bring to the forefront something. This was my first visit to Washington, D.C. for one of these. And the experience I received from this tells me there's a little spark of hope when I see 11 veterans up there, very intelligent, very professional, give information, and people took notice. I got around a room and I was wondering, you know, are we just blind? Are we being ignored? But when I walked around the room, two of the people that I remember being there is one was the AMVETS. The director of AMVETS was there. That's one. But as I walked around the room, I also found the American Legion there. I think they're starting to realize, and they're starting to look at this really hard. And I hope it made an impression on them that we have intelligent people out there. We can go on the Internet and find most of the stuff and then come back and tell them about it, and they're surprised. It's not enough. What we see and what we gather and what we put out is making a difference. And to have a group like that go up there every time there's a rag would be amazing. But it was, in my eyes, it was a little bit of hope sparked because we had some followers. And I could name all of them. There were 11 of them, and we all had something to say, and we all got our point across, and we all got them to understand. I talked to some of the researchers on the team, Leah Steele, Dr. Nancy Klimas. I talked to Dr. Roberta White, and they made me feel so much at home. You know, when you get up for the first time to speak in front of a very distinguished committee like this, it should make you nervous. I felt at home by the time I got ready to go. And I really appreciate Jim Benz because he was excited. He had that spark, and he thought there was hope for us yet. And it really makes a difference.
There's something I want to bring up here.
Before you go on, Doug, the bill I was referring to that the VVA worked on is Senate Bill 1602, the Toxic Exposure Research and Military Family Support Act, and was introduced by Senator Richard Blumenthal, who we met with his staffers, and it would establish within the Department of Veterans Affairs a national center for diagnosis, treatment, and research of the health conditions of these veterans, and to provide the diagnostic treatment and care to them. Right now, we do not have one center, except for the war-related illness and injury, that is dedicated to these toxic substances. We have MS registry. We have ALS registry now. We have various centers of excellence within the VA, but there is not a center of excellence for toxic injuries. And so the VVA, got this bill done, and it's by Senator Blumenthal. So we need to support that effort also. It would help all of us, no matter what era. And again, that Senate Bill 1602, the Toxic Exposure Research and Military Family Support Act.
That's real important. Now, there's something else. You guys were so busy in Washington, D.C. on April 28th. There was an article in Army Times, and it's from the Command Sergeant Major, disturbing number of motorcycle incidents among NCOs and everything else. Now, I started riding my motorcycle. I got my first motorcycle for my 16th birthday. I just had turned 65 the other day, so it's been a long time. But as Denise, as you know, I can't ride the motorcycle anymore, and with the stuff that showed up recently with all the balance problems, I guess I'm coming back up because you and I have discussed this before. We've had other individuals that have been on motorcycles to discuss this. We have so horrible neurological problems in all the vets. We have incredible problems with balance. And the stuff that I just confirmed to myself, again, when you're on a motorcycle, if I'm going to the left, everything's okay, but I want to go to the right because of the balance and neurological problems that are affecting the right on the balance, I lose the balance, and therefore you can't ride safely. The other thing you do is you got all the hearing problems. You got incredible vision problems and vision disturbances. So the word and caution I've got out is, guys, if you were over there and got toxic exposure, you really got to stop and think about riding a motorcycle because, I mean, the data is out there. They're saying we got way too many accidents, and the question I have, but I got to base it on my own neurological and problems and everything else, is maybe we can't ride anymore. I took my motorcycle apart because the doctor said, Doug, it's not safe.
Yeah. Doug, you know, early on, I tracked our vets that got out of service, tried to get a job, got a drug job with a trucking company. I know many that tried to do that. They had to quit their jobs because they would get lost, disoriented. If it was raining and nighttime, the visual deceptions that we have, disruptions in our visual perception, were dangerous. I've had pilots that had problems. I was up on the hill when they had one of the helicopters run into another helicopter taxiing in. And we had the same thing happen with our pilots that went with commercial airlines. I had one that I've known from before the war that was flying with an airline and taxiing in. He hit another airline tip to tip. It's visual distortions that we're having and perception abilities are altered. We've had no visual research into the effects of this, and that has to be a push. Our vision is so important to us, and to have it completely ignored, although I've brought up the visual problems, the dental problems, over and over again. Hearing gets some attention with, you know, the ringing in your ear and the loss of hearing, although those ratings are, for some reason, hard for some to get. But vision is ignored. Dental problems are ignored. And these are significant portions of your body.
Well, the dental problems have been ignored, and I've had spouses, and again, I just referred another spouse to you again. You probably haven't talked to them yet, where they know their husband was exposed current time to all this stuff. The husband's got the dental problems, and now the spouse is having the dental problems, where the teeth are just, they're not decaying. The teeth are just literally deteriorating, pressing apart, is what we've been seeing on all of us for a long time.
Yeah.
And that goes back to the decalcification and dephosphorization of the tooth. The
right.
Structural deterioration, not a decay, a structural deterioration.
Right.
So, you brought this up from day one.
Yeah, I've been bringing it up, and it's so far been on deaf ears. And so what I'm asking people to do is, if you have a good dentist that, you know, maybe university affiliated with the university, or a good eye doctor that's affiliated, we can encourage them to put in for the CDMRP funding. And there needs to be these studies done. They're just as important as the other studies, and I think more important because they're not being paid attention to.
The medical professionals, I mean, yourself, how many other doctors and nurses have we known that have given up primary care practice because of the memory problems and the fine motor control problems, the fatigue problems and all this stuff, the neurological problems? I mean, it's way too high. And we lost incredibly phenomenal people because they just made the decision it wasn't safe. I mean, you've been hearing that from what, day one?
Yeah, from day one. It's heartbreaking. I mean, this is, you know, any person that loses their profession over this, but for sure our healthcare providers that were affected. I wish more and more of them would speak out and admit to their problems and why they were job hopping for a while.
Yeah.
I hear the music coming up, Doug.
Yeah, well, thank you, David. Thank you, Denise. Thanks for all the good work. Write up a summary for all of this so we can get on the archives, would you please?
I sure will, Doug.
Okay, thank you, guys. Good evening. God bless everybody. Thanks.
Good evening.